Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN. Today we're off to the 14th Istanbul Biennial, where some very political Aboriginal art is on show.
The idea of those paintings is that they are human faces of the brutaliser, the oppressor, and they are the faces that have been distorted by these acts of brutality.
Artist Vernon Arkey there, and before that, Susan Wald, an artist who sits in on rehearsals to paint actors at work.
What Susan is doing is accessing the kind of internal world of a production. She's capturing it on a deep level and is keeping it alive.
But first, a spectacular ballet premieres in Melbourne. David McAllister and I are leaping about the studio to this dreamy music by Tchaikovsky from the 1889 ballet Sleeping Beauty. Last week, the Australian Ballet's production premiered in Melbourne. It takes its cues from the original Russian production, but this version has really upped the ante on opulence and glitz. There are lovely sets, glittering chandeliers, the whole thing. And the man who's responsible for all this pizzazz is the artistic director of the Australian Ballet, who won't stop chuckling. Hello, David McAllister.
Pizzazz, I love that word.
Put me down, man. So you must be very excited. I gather this is the first time you've done a full-length, you've choreographed it full-length.
Very first time. I did a little opening for our 50th anniversary for a 10-minute piece, which was fun. But I think that sort of gave me the confidence to take this one on.
I suppose. I mean, a sensible person would have started small. Why didn't you do some sort of avant-garde work in a garage somewhere?
Well, I've never been a sensible person.
you heard it here first. So you were famously a principal dancer with the company. Did you ever dance this ballet yourself?
I did, actually. I danced it many, many times. I started actually off in the quarter ballet, and I think I just about danced every role in The Sleeping Beauty except for Aurora. So it was a ballet that we did a lot because Mani Gilgud did a production in 1984 that opened the Art Centre. And I was a fairy cavalier and a Polonaise couple and a garland dance boy.
I'm sorry, a fairy cavalier.
I know. And they were very fairy, those cavaliers, I've got to say. Yeah. But I sort of grew up in this ballet.
Right. Mm. So remind us about the story. What's the story?
Well, the story is very simple. And in fact, the really interesting thing about this ballet is the story gets told in the very first half an hour, and then you've got 2.5 hours more of just lovely dancing. It's about this beautiful young princess, Aurora, who gets born to a king and queen who have obviously tried very hard to have a baby because she's the only heir to the throne. And on the christening, they invite all of these fairy godmothers to come and bestow blessings upon her of beauty and elegance and beautiful voice. But they, in some stories, forget to invite Carabosse, who is, sort of the older fairy. In my production, I sort of made it a little bit more that she's not just, oh, whoops, we forgot to invite Carabosse. It's actually a thing that Catalibut, who's sort of like the head of the royal household, actually makes a choice not to invite Carabosse. So,
and who's Carabosse?
Carabosse is, well, she's in the original production, she's called the fairy, the older fairy. And the reason she isn't invited in the original production is because they thought that she may not... No one had seen her in the kingdom, and they thought that maybe she had either left or passed away or something. But in the production, I tried to make a bit more sense of that because it's a bit sort of weird to have a whole ballet revolving around a whoops, we forgot. So I decided that she's the fairy of wisdom, and I built this sort of little backstory between her and Lilac, because Lilac Fairy is obviously the fairy of beauty, and she is the one that is the sort of leader of all of the fairy godmothers. And I feel like there, for me, it made more sense that there was some sort of a coup between Carabosse and Lilac, and the fairy. I think of Carabosse as the fairy of wisdom, and age and wisdom is often sort of overlooked by youth and beauty.
Now, the Lilac Fairy, I know, has an extremely lovely dress.
And she certainly does.
The costumes are a real feature of this show. They're a pure indulgence. So the costume designer is Gabriella Tyler Sova.
Yeah.
And just tell us briefly about her.
Well, I think she's one of the greatest designers in the world, not just in Australia. She is an amazing woman. And she worked with us once before on a ballet, Scheherazade, which was extraordinary. But she also has designed operas and theatre, and she designed Love Never Dies, the extraordinary lavish production for Lloyd Webber. So she's an amazing, incredible woman.
Well, Anna Frey Taylor went to visit Gabriella Tyler-Sova in the costume department of the Australian Ballet.
We've got probably 150, 200 costumes. There's so many costumes in this show. We've ordered fabric from all around the world. So we've got beautiful wools from England. We've got lace. We've got flowers from New York, like silk flowers handmade. So, you know, there's going to be lots of different things from different countries contributing to Australian Sleeping Beauty.
Well, we're sitting in the costume department of the Australian Ballet here in Melbourne, and in front of us we have your sketchbooks. Can you take me through some of the designs?
Yeah. So this is the Ladies' Bible, which is like a working Bible. We've got swatches of fabric. As you can see, there's a drawing of Aurora. And these are all the different layers for colours for her tutu. We've gone, it's not usually one or two fabrics. I've got, there's variation of fabrics on all costumes. And then we've got for art finishing as well. So there's a real depth of colour when you see them on stage. And I'm quite nuts about art finishing because I really love it. And I think it, you know, it just enhances the costume so much. So we shade, we basically create extra shading in the costume. So when you have folds or creases of fabric, we spray deeper tones inside. So it looks, it gives it much more three-dimensional effect and depth.
It's like costume makeup for the costumes.
That's correct. That's a great way of putting it. I never thought about it that way. Yes, it's a costume makeup. Which always happens at the last minute, because it's the once the costume is finished, that's when the art finisher can attack it and start spraying.
So let's just describe for the listener what we have in this book. We've got a picture of the ballerina.
Princess, that's right. This is Princess Aurora. It's a quite traditional tutu, except it's not traditional. We've gone, there's a, in the Act 1, all the girls appear, they're based on roses, the designs. So it looks like large, she's got like large rose petals as her top skirt. And then she's got lots of pearls attached to it. And again, there's art finishing in the creases of the petals. And there's pearls placed on, they look like a dew drops, basically. Or that's the idea behind it.
This is on top of her tutu. And around the sides of the page are different swatches of fabric.
That's right. So the different swatches, and you can as well, there's scribbles of numbers because they come from different countries, from different swatch books. And this is for the buyer to know, you know, where we get them from. It's called Costume Bible because it's got all the information about the costumes, how they, where the fabrics come from, who made, you know, if there was embroidery, who did the embroidery? Or as I said, we had the flowers made, where were they made? And you get samples of everything in the Bible. Which means if any other company wants to remake the show, they get sent the Bibles and they follow them and they can reproduce them.
Amazing. Like a reference book.
Yes, it is like a reference book, and the Bible should never leave the costume department, and it is guarded as a Bible. So any buyer would just kill you if you want to do anything with it. Which means, you know, or yeah. So I usually can't, you know, so I can't ever sneak it out if I need to or something. It's like, no, you don't touch it.
Secret documents.
It is, secret documents, exactly. There's Carabos, that's one of the evil fairies. She's lots of children's favorite, I suppose, you know, the body. So she is made out of these fantastic fabrics. I actually don't know where they're from. I think they're from France. And it's this lurex, but it looks great. It doesn't look like a cheap lurex. It's black. It's based on a black, kind of looks like an organza, chiffony organza fabric. And then there is twinkly blue. You can get them in different tones, but we've got a blue-black lurex fabric in there. So she's made out of bits and pieces. She should look like a bird or made out of pieces of made-up feathers, basically. And the whole skirt moves. She's got a large collar, wig, quite stylized makeup. Yeah, she's evil, but she still needs to look glamorous, like David wanted her to be glamorous and beautiful, so she's not just this evil, horrible thing. Because in some productions, actually played by men, like there's some Russian shows I've seen, and it's like a bloke looking shocking, you know. So David said, no, she's glamorous, she's just really angry, and that's why she's doing the bad spell casting on the princess. Hello. I'll just go quick. There's our one of our fairies, which is the Lilac Fairy. There's been lots of said about Lilac Fairy. She's the fairy of beauty, and so she's based on the lilac flowers. And the construction has been quite an epic journey to get this costume done, because we've gone from small, tiny petals to big petals in the tutu. Musette, who is the head cutter for the ladies' department, she's done so many mock-ups and toiles for this one. And I think we've got her right, and she's looking absolutely beautiful. You have to see the show to see her. I can't describe it.
I get the feeling that you like your job.
I love the job, yeah. I mean, I couldn't do it if I, you know, it's like me staying up really late last night because I just got excited. I thought, oh, I have to do this. You know, it can be really stressful as well, and, you know, but at the end of the day, it's all about the show, and the show needs to look good. And at the end of the day, I sit there watching, and I just go, you know, it's great, I love it. I'll do it again, even though during the process you go, oh, never again. This is too much.
Anna Frey Taylor, who also loves her job, with Gabriella Tylosova in the costume department of the Australian Ballet, having the privilege of consulting the costume Bible. And my guest this morning in the studio is the artistic director of the Australian Ballet, David McAllister, and we're talking about his sumptuous production of Sleeping Beauty. I'm so pleased you didn't use any cheap Lurex.
I know.
I thought for a moment there, oh no, Lurex.
Yeah, there's no cheap fabrics in this show.
You saw to that. So the original ballet was choreographed by Marius Petipa, who's one of these kind of founder figures of Russian ballet. Did you research the original production?
I did a lot, actually, and with a lot of material that Nicolette Frayon found and gave to me, especially about the music and the collaboration between Tchaikovsky and Petipa. It was really... it was an interesting, fascinating journey, and I felt like I learnt so much about this ballet. Even though dancing it for many years, you know, you only have a sort of a workman knowledge. I think the inspiration behind a lot of the choreography and the actual reasons why things were done the way they were was really fascinating.
So do you know what steps he created?
Roughly. I mean, there is notation, but it's a very old-fashioned style of notation. And in fact, Alexei Rybmansky just recently taught himself how to read that notation. And when he did the production of Sleeping Beauty for American Ballet Theatre earlier this year, he actually took it off the original notation. So it's quite authentic. But I guess, I mean, I wanted it to have a 21st century look. I didn't really want to go backwards. And I think the dancers today dance very differently to what they did in 1890. So, you know, I wanted it to be using the technique of today, but based on the, you know, choreographic style of Petipa.
And there are so many strong female parts in this ballet, which I guess makes it quite special.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, it was the period where the ballerina reigned supreme, and Carlotta Brianza, who was the original Aurora, was an incredibly technical, strong Italian dancer. And interestingly, when Diaghilev did his production in the 1920s, she played the queen, which was a nice little sort of segue on. But it was a very tough and quite, you know, exciting production technically. And the way people wrote about it at that time was quite fascinating.
And you've spared no expense. I mean, it's cost, well, it says here $2 million to put on this production. That sounds like an underestimation to me.
Well, yeah, it did go over a little bit. But, I mean, the good thing was that we actually raised $1.8 million from our donors. So it was an amazing exercise in people getting behind this production and supporting it.
Oh, so they supported this particular production.
Yeah, so Kenneth Watkins, who's our head of philanthropy, did a campaign specifically to raise money for this production. So on one hand, it is, you know, very opulent and expensive. But as far as, you know, coming out of our coffers, it's one of the cheapest full-length productions we've done.
So fairy tales are often dark and unsettling, but it sounds like you've gone for the light.
Well, I think the music is very, you know, it has a lot of that beauty in it. And
it's joyful music, isn't it? It makes you feel good the moment you hear it.
And, you know, Perrault, who wrote the, you know, original story, I mean, all of those fairy stories had their very dark sides. But, you know, the ballet in the 1800s tended to sort of like to glorify, you know, the lighter aspects of the stories.
So it's really about the dance and the storytelling, is it, rather than, you know, deep philosophical issues?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an escapist work. It's definitely not making, you know, political statements about anything much.
We're there to have... there, he said it. We're there to have a good time.
Yeah, and look, you know, and it is the glorification of, you know, beauty and the art form. I mean, I think it is a love poem to ballet, actually. And Petipar was, you know, saying in this work, this is a glorious art form and I want to celebrate it.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of politics around the arts at the moment, especially around big companies like yours. So the former arts minister, George Brandis, Senator George Brandis, was a great supporter of the ballet, a supporter of what I call the masterpiece arts of orchestras and ballet and so on. Are you concerned that the new minister may not share his sympathies?
Look, I'm not, because I think, you know, as far as a company's concerned, you know, the Australian Ballet is a very well-behaved arts company because we don't live beyond our means and we, you know, we have great support. Our government funding is only really 16% of our budget. So, you know, we're not, you know...
You can buy a lot of sequins with 16% of your budget,
though. Absolutely.
A lot of swatches.
A lot of Lurex. But you know, compared to, you know, some of the other arts, I think, you know, the ballet company is very well run financially. And I think, you know, the national companies are really important to Australia, you know, as flagship organisations for our culture. And, you know, I believe every level of, you know, arts funding is important.
How often do you get overseas as a company?
We usually do annual tours. We're just about to embark a tour to China straight after the Perth season of Sleeping Beauty. And we've got plans to go back to Europe. We were in America last year. So we do actually sort of fly the flag around the globe.
Right. So it actually is quite an important part of, well, what's sometimes called cultural diplomacy, I guess.
And look, I think the good thing that, you know, the current government have done is actually really raise that level of cultural diplomacy. And you know, we've been really working with the government to try and make sure that, you know, we can do that, because I think it is good to show the world that, you know, Australia has a ballet company and it's world class.
As we wind up, has this given you a taste for choreography? Are there more big shows to come?
Oh, look, I don't know. We're going to do a children's ballet and I'm doing that, and we're calling that The Little Beauty. So
it's going to... The Little Beauty.
The Little Beauty. It's not going to be a big show.
Yeah. Well, I think you should spell it with a D, though. Your little beauties.
Beauty, exactly.
Oh, I think you're on a winner there, mate. David McAllister is the Artistic Director of the Australian Ballet, and his production of Sleeping Beauty is on at the Arts Centre in Melbourne until the 26th of September, and then it tours to Perth and on to Sydney, and you'll find details of all the performances there on our website. This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Still to come, the very edgy art of the Istanbul Biennial. Well, Sleeping Beauty is a theatrical production which is designed, as David says, just to delight us. But now we venture into some darker woods. Susan Wald is an artist whose project is to paint actors in performance, and she's documented actors at work by sitting on rehearsals for two productions 20 years apart. And the brooding pictures that she's made are now on show. And you can see the ones we're about to discuss right now if you go along to our website. She's waiting at a gallery called Langford 120 to tell us more. And we're outside Gallery Langford 120. It's called that because it's on Langford Street in North Melbourne. Out the front is Susan Wald, the artist we've come to visit. Hello.
Hello, Michael.
Take us inside and we'll get out of this noisy industrial street. So we step inside and here's all your marvellous work. So what's the premise of this exhibition?
Well, it stems from theatre, from two productions. One is Barry Kosky's The Exile Trilogy that was performed... Oh, now 20 years ago.
In the olden days.
In the very olden days, yes.
When people still called Barry an enfant terrible. So Barry Kosky was a young director in Melbourne and in Sydney, but he was based in Melbourne, making waves, upsetting people, delighting people. He now is a major director in Berlin where he's got his own opera theatre to play with. There you were way back then with his production of the Exile Trilogy. So at that stage, you're a young aspiring artist.
Yes. It was not long after art school, and I was very lucky to be able to draw during rehearsals for the three productions, and they were 1 year apart, each one.
So this was a very long-term project.
It was.
You didn't understand mortality at that stage.
That's right.
Now, also standing by to help us look at these is Adina Jacobs, who is a director in her own right, equally as exciting as Barry Kosky.
Thanks, Michael.
And you were the director of the second production that caught Susan's eye.
So I directed a production of Electra in 2010 at the Dog Theatre in Footscray, and we rehearsed with my company Fraud Outfit in an incredibly small room, and Susan was sitting in the room the whole time drawing and part of the process, which has evolved into this sort of extraordinary body of work.
But you mean you're there doing all the stuff that actors and directors do, crawling on the floor. And meanwhile, there's Susan 20 years after she did the first project with her paints, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think the rehearsal room is a private space that I wish more people could witness, because in some ways the content of the show is often more present in the rehearsal room than it is in the final production, when you have to sculpt it, when you have to make it meaningful to an audience and find coherence. But in its most raw form, it's absolutely thrilling, and I think that's what Susan was able to be a part of in that room.
Well, that's the trick, though, is to translate the thrill of the rehearsal room into the stage, because I think the mistake directors make, Adina, sometimes, is they try to put the experiment of the rehearsal room onto the stage, and actually it's not that great to watch actors, quote, exploring.
As a director, when you see something in the heat of the moment, or when an actor discovers something for the first time, it feels like it's the thing. But actually, in theatre, you need to mould an image or an event or an action so that it can be expressed again and again for an audience.
Do you think we can look at one work and say this absolutely captures that moment? Or for you, is the impact the whole collection? Is it one giant work of exuberance?
I think it's a process of all the work, because I start at the theatre with the sketches in a sketchbook, and that happens during the rehearsals. And then from then onwards, I did a body of monoprints.
What's a monoprint?
So you have a plate and you ink it up, and you can wipe away the image, or you can just brush it on with an ink and brush as well. So most of the time I rolled the ink on to this plate, and then...
And is the plate etched?
No, it's on the top.
Oh,
the ink
I
is
see.
On the top, and it's wiped away with tools and rags.
Oh, and that's how you create the image.
Well, it allows you to work really quickly.
Yeah, I get it.
Through ideas, and when after I did a body of that work, I then started the small paintings that went then on to the bigger paintings.
It's a chain reaction for you.
Yes, yes.
Now, we're standing in front of four little pictures that you made in response to Adina's process. Do you recognise these, Adina?
I do. I'm always trying to walk around thinking, who is that and what moment was that?
Right.
But as Susan said, they are extracted from the original moment.
And so we're looking at the first one here, which appears to be a man cowering under a bed or something.
Actually a woman who was playing the chorus cowering under a bed.
Okay.
I think what's really interesting about this painting and all of them is that on the one hand, it's a document of a particular moment in the production, which I remember very well as the director. But on the other hand, because it's contained within a fixed frame and we're only looking at a part of the bed and the expression on this performer's face, it communicates something deeper about the piece itself.
It's a moment of raw emotion, isn't it?
It is.
Which is actually what choruses partly are.
I think in the case of this production, we had one performer, Karen Sibbing, who was playing the entire chorus, and she acted as a kind of receptacle for all of the horrors of the house. That painting, for me, captures her response to an awful event that's just taking place.
So it's like an emotional snapshot. The face is caught in a very sort of pink, almost fleshy way. The figure is lying on a very dark, foreboding ground, as if the whole of the universe is dark and there is no place in the world that might be light.
Yes, yes. And I also wanted to leave it ambiguous as to what she was lying under, or what that could be.
Well, yes, it could be actually a heavy rock, now that I look at it, squashing a poor woman.
Yeah.
So we're standing in front of a whole line of pictures, some from your production, Adina, and some from Barry Kosky's production. Let's look at another one that jumps out at you from coming from your work.
This painting here is it's the chorus. It's Chrysothemis, the sister of Electra, and Electra, who is cowering against the wall in a moment of grief. After Electra hears that her brother is dead, mistakenly hears that her brother is dead, and we're drawn into a mystery we don't understand. And I think something Susan's captured here as well is the lighting in the production. There were light bulbs hanging from the ceiling, and the way that the shadows are reflected on the wall is incredibly interesting as a document of the theatre, because it's as much a kind of representation of the actual visual moment as something expressive. Mm.
Is it a dark thing that you do? I mean, are you going to a dark place in your own soul to create these brooding images?
I don't know if it's a dark place, but it's a deep place. I work to try and find an abstraction. So I work with the energies, the forces.
You know what this reminds me of? I once saw a production by Barikofsky of The Back Eye. Barry, if you're listening, I loved your description of The Back Eye. And you said in the notes that you wanted us to imagine that The Back Eye was occurring somewhere under the floor, and that you'd captured, or that we were experiencing, the kind of radiation from the play, that up here in the theatre, where people were going, meat, 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 they did a lot of that, we were exposed to the kind of raw anger and fleshiness of the play. Is that the kind of feeling? That sense of the kind of psychic buzz, yes, that comes off the play?
Yes, definitely, definitely. There's a real energy and deep dark.
Adina Jacobs, one of the torments of being a theatre director is that you are working in an ephemeral art form. And so in 50 years' time, when you're an old lady, you'll say, you should have seen my back eye, and nobody cares. But you can see it as vividly as anything, because it'll feel to you, trust me, that when you're an old lady, that your back eye was only just yesterday. This somehow gives some tangibility to our revels now are ended.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most beautiful and fascinating things about Susan's project and this body of work. What Susan is doing is accessing the kind of internal world of a production. She's capturing it on a deep level and is keeping it alive. I think, you know, there's that very odd thing at the end of a theatre production where the set's torn down irreverently and it's over. But in the case of Electra, for example, Sue's been working for 5 years on these paintings, and inside of them there is a sense of haunted figures, people who are cursed people. It's a Greek tragedy, so the notion of memory is incredible, and grief is hugely important. So the content of the work is about memory, but also the act of doing it feels like a kind of desire to resist that erasure of the event itself.
So your painting, Susan, is almost mystical.
Thank you.
Artist Susan Wald, and alongside her theatre director Adina Jacobs. And you can see those mystical images from Susan's show on our website. Or if you're in Melbourne, you can visit the show at the gallery. It's called Langford 120, and you'll find details of that on our website. And just a note, the production of The Back Eye that I mentioned there wasn't Barikofsky's sumptuous 2006 production in Sydney. It was a very stark version that he presented in Melbourne back in the early 90s. And yes, they said meat a lot, meat, like that. On RN, this is Books and Arts. Now we head to Istanbul. Oh yes, the glorious city of Istanbul, and there's a consensus among art critics that this year's biennial is one of the edgiest events on the international art circuit. Carolyn Christoph Bakargiev is its curator, although she prefers the term draftsperson, apparently. You might recognise her name. She ran the 2008 Sydney Biennale, or Biennale, and then the highly acclaimed Documenta Contemporary Art event in Germany in 2012. Fiona Gruber was recently in beautiful Istanbul, and she joins me now. Good morning.
Hello, Michael.
Isn't it a lovely city?
Oh, it's a thrilling city.
I mean,
city.
When you're out there on the Bosphorus, you could be looking at a city that is sort of 1,000 years old.
I know. You really do feel that, you know, you are meeting Europe and Asia, ancient and modern. It's just a huge kind of melee. And it's there at a very kind of tense and exciting time. It's full of refugees from Syria.
Well, you know, it's famously at the crossroads of Asia and of Europe. I mean, we could say at the crossroads of kind of the Arab world, really, and of Europe, and it is now the crossroads of all this misery.
That's right. And you might think that having a you know, a fancy art festival is a bit of a frippery at such times. But in fact, Caroline Christophe Pekargiev, she really does believe that art can change souls, and that's why she's a, you know, curator, not a politician, because she really believes that the ideas can trickle down and change the way people think. So she's taken over the entire city, even underwater. There's actually a stage off an island in the Bosphorus that the artist Pierre Huyghe has created. I think lobsters might be performing on it. There is a most amazing series of sculptures, again in the sea, by an Argentinian artist, Adrian Villarrojas. And the setting is amazing because it is in the grounds of Trotsky's villa on an island, again in the sea.
All right. Well, there's lots to talk about. We're also going to hear from two of the Australian artists involved, the Brisbane-based artist Vernon Arkey and Jambawa Marawili, who's a Yolngu artist from northeast Arnhem Land.
Yes, but first let's hear from the curator, or draft person, Caroline Christophe Pekargiev, about why she chose saltwater as the theme for this year's Istanbul Biennial.
Saltwater provided a very broad metaphor, let's say, or floating signifier within which to think about creativity, art, science, of course, but also in other more metaphorical senses, it is in salt water that, of course, the bodies of the Middle Passage, you know, fell during those hundreds of years of slavery across the Atlantic, and the thought of those bodies under there, or in the Mediterranean today, people dying while trying to cross the Mediterranean into Europe, brings in another, let's say, darker side of what salt water is on our planet.
In your introductory speech the other day, you featured the work by the Yirrkala artists and also Vernon Arkey really prominently. Tell us a bit about why you invited them here and how central they are to the ideas that you're interested in for this Biennale.
Well, I look at the waves of history and the repeated knots that are knotted by humans and their environment. And in thinking about Anatolia, these lands where we are, and the Middle East, the nearby wars going on in Syria and Iraq, but also across the Black Sea, Ukraine, the civil wars there and so forth, it occurred to me that this former Ottoman Empire also somehow unraveled through a number of tremendous and horrendous ethnic cleansing procedures. I'm referring to the, of course, the Armenian Mez Yegern, which means genocide, and the Greeks. So all of these elements that are the layers and waves of history and brutality from one peoples to another in Anatolia got me thinking about the various other parts of the world where such knots have been tied. And having lived in Australia for a while and done the Sydney Biennial in 2008, I have a rather acute consciousness or awareness of the relations between Indigenous peoples and the descendants of the colonizers in Australia. And saltwater paintings are a number of paintings that in the late 2000s were made by members of the Yolngu tribe in northern Arnhem Land, including Jambawa Marawili, and they were used as evidence in trials in order to achieve sea rights for the first time in the history of Australia. They are preceded, however, by a very important document called the Bark Petition, a 1963 document sent down by the Yolngu elders of the time, who wanted to claim land restitutions and land rights for Aboriginals. Also because the Bark Petition may be the first activist artwork in history. So there are many young artists that are observing that document, which is a paper which was stuck onto a piece of bark with painting all around it. It's a bit of a constitutional document now for Australia, and it does speak to the transformative potential that art has. So it occurred to me that by bringing in these stories from distant lands, one could obliquely also discuss what is undiscussable here in Turkey.
Mama, My name is Will Stubbs. I'm a coordinator at Bukularinge Mulka Centre from Irkalla. So that's an Aboriginal arts centre or a collective non-profit organisation from Irkalla, northeast Arnhem Land. So we were invited by Carolyn Christoph Bogachev when she visited last year to become involved, and she had a vision revealing to a wider audience the role that art has played in the political struggle of Yolngu to achieve some kind of self-determination.
Now, the theme of this biennale is salt water, and for the Yolngu people and for Irkalla, this is a really important theme, isn't it, Will?
The Yolngu culture uses water as a tool to model and philosophise about cosmology, ritual, spirituality, politics, kinship, connection. So the science of water and understanding the way it behaves and ascribing identities to it is really profound and probably, you know, much more so than any other world culture, I'd suspect. And so in 1998, Djambwa Marawili was advised by his Djungaya or caretaker Waka Munungur that a very sacred site for Yolngu people, for Marapa clan, the place called Garangali, which is a coastal area, had been desecrated by an illegal fishing camp. And in this place, which is the nest of the crocodile, metaphorically was the severed head of a crocodile, which is was a great sacrilege. And it was in frustration at the continual incursion of non-Indigenous people into sacred things that drove Djambwa to form a coalition of 47 artists who created 80 paintings known as the Saltwater Collection, which went on to be an impetus towards, through a 10-year legal struggle, their eventual success in the High Court in a case known as the Blue Mud Bay case, which recognised Yolngu ownership of the sea down to the tidal zone, so which is a first legally and a major watershed.
Djambwa, you're sitting here in Istanbul. Tell me, how significant are these paintings to your people?
Well, it's so important. It is really important for our people back in Australia. We do claim ourselves by singing and also by dancing, we always claim the country at in our base or in our sea.
And you've painted a new painting to add to the ones from the Saltwater Collection. Tell us about the new painting.
The new painting that I was painting, that was me really reaching out Turkey.
Do you think people outside of Australia look at Aboriginal art differently from people inside Australia?
Well, you know, I think, what shall I say? Well, the art is really important for people who are living in Australia, and I think they do have their own significant way of taking responsibility. And, well, as the people who are outside the world, I think they can see what is happening. Some arts really went into a really deep document, you can say, you know I think the government people are not starting to realize now, and they can see it is not just patterns or colorful pattern. It is really meant to tell them the ownership of the countries and the sea.
Vernon and Arkeith's work is a very, very politically overt statement about brutality. A series of five paintings next to a video called The Tall Man about Palm Island. So, Vernon, tell us a bit more about the work that you've put in for the Istanbul Biennale.
Well, I have a series of five paintings that I call brutalities, and they are essentially, the idea behind them is that when an individual or a group or a society chooses brutality as their first best option, they commit themselves to hostility and violence and often oppression and suppression and desperation. But to do that, to commit yourself, necessarily you give up your humanity. You set it aside. And so you're giving up compassion, rationalism, kindness and goodness. But the idea of those paintings is that they are human faces of the brutalizer, the oppressor, and they are the faces that have been distorted by these acts of brutality. They have no eyes and no mouths, no, there is a nose that's been kind of elongated into either a beak or a snout, and the brow gives an impression of the furrows give an impression of maybe feathers, I don't know, or fur, I don't know, but you know, so sliding towards this kind of beastly idea, but more so they are still recognizably human faces, but they are beastly because they behave brutally.
You made these works especially for this Biennale. When you were invited here by Caroline Christophe Bakargiev, what were the kind of themes that you discussed with her?
Well, I was aware that 2015 is the 100-year anniversary of the Armenian massacres. 2015 is the date given, but they kind of began before that and continued for some years after. And Caroline sent me on this kind of fact-finding mission to Eastern Turkey, but really it was to visit these churches, and you go to these churches and you research their histories, and you find out that all their histories ceased in 1915, and some of them were being worshipped in up until that time, and these are older than medieval churches, and so quite fascinating history, but there's no sense of worship in them anymore, and it's unfortunate. Some of the churches had been blown up and looted by armed forces. So it was quite depressing, really, and disappointing that, you know, people do this to other people.
Accompanying the paintings, there's the video, The Tall Man, which has been shown in Australia, and it's about the riots on Palm Island in 2004. Now, you've subtitled them for the local audiences, but you subtitled them in Turkish, Armenian and Kurdish. That's a very overt political statement. What kind of reaction have you got from local audiences to that?
I've had some comments, some reactions, mostly positive so far. It won't surprise me at all if I get negative comments, but the idea was I want this to be a conversation between these three languages and with me and with the kind of context, the Aboriginal context in Australia, historically and currently. And so I want people to come in and follow the narrative of the day, but to see that there is a discourse happening there that is intentional and is asking some hard questions about the state of affairs, both here in this country and in Australia.
Your work is next door to the work by the Yirrkala artists, the Saltwater Petition, the Bark Petition. How do you see the link between your work and their work? Is it all about the same thing, essentially?
Well, the thing is that those works together are really a demonstration of sovereignty. Carolyn's not displaying them as art. I don't even know how aware Djambawa is that his own artworks are being displayed in a context of kind of documentary evidence of this idea of sovereignty, because we, as Aborigines, we've yet to be realised as a fully human peoples, and because there's no acknowledgement of sovereignty. And so there's that's the beginning. So Australia's still a long way off that. There's no beginning yet. There's just occupation.
artist Vernon R. Key speaking there to Fiona Gruber, who was a guest of the Istanbul Foundation for Culture and Arts. And the Istanbul Biennial runs until the 1st of November, and you'll find a link to that on our website here at Books and Arts. Now, Fiona, you're presenting Books and Arts tomorrow, and you have a very big scoop.
I do indeed. On my travels, I interviewed Clive James, a poet, critic, TV broadcaster in Cambridge, and he's been very ill for the last 5 years with leukemia, but I'm very pleased to say that he's actually okay. There are new drugs and they're keeping him stable, and he's writing up a storm, and I had a fantastic chat.
Well, that is
him.
A scoop, because I mean, we've all understood that Clive was dying.
Yeah, he said he was dying. Well, he didn't make it up, but it was in March and he thought he was, and then amazingly a special drug that targets his kind of blood cancer was made available, and it's really changed things. He's not a well man, but he is able to continue writing, and he said he's got a new creative lease of life.
And what's he talk about in the interview we'll hear tomorrow?
All about books, about his ideas, about his split with his wife, about a little bit about the affair that caused it, his regrets, his absolute love of Australia and how he misses it. A bit about politics. He's quite mischievous. All the things he said off air, I wish I could have kept on. But no, it's a fascinating interview, though I say it myself.
You'll have to have a sealed edition or something.
he is totally charming.
Yeah, he is a charming man. I remember interviewing him in this very studio 15 years ago, a long time ago. All right, well, that's Books and Arts tomorrow with Fiona.
Thank you very much.
Space exploration is just in the human heart.
We've been wondering about the stars forever and straining to get to them for more than six decades.
Civilizations are like individuals. We grow when we challenge ourselves. We stagnate when we do not. A Humans to Mars program would be a tremendously productive challenge for all the societies that engage in it.
The push to explore space. Let me, Erica Vowles, take you off Earth with Outward Bound. A look at humans in space. Sunday at 3:30.
I can't wait till Sunday to 3:30. I want to go now, Erica. I want to go into space with you right now. Now, I wonder how you get your news about arts these days. I know you listen to Books and Arts. Of course you do. Perhaps you visit certain websites or you click through social media. Perhaps you prefer the old-fashioned way of reading the newspaper, the Saturday supplements and so on, watching the telly. The ABC's just announced the launch of a new ABC Arts channel, which you'll be able to watch exclusively on iView. And some media reports are saying that this is the end of arts on free-to-air TV. It's not important enough to put on the free-to-air TV, they're saying, and they banished it to iView. Well, to get to the bottom of all this, we have the ABC's Nicola Harvey, who is the supervising producer and editor of Arts Online, including iView, to explain what's going on. Welcome to Books and Arts, Nicola.
Thanks, Michael.
So there was a report in the Fairfax Press by Carl Quinn that the ABC has all but abandoned arts coverage on the telly, and that the implication was that iView is a sort of, I don't know, less important way of giving you your arts, I guess, a less visible way of doing it.
I have to disagree there. Let me be quite clear. The ABC TV division is most certainly not stepping back from arts programming on our main channels. We launched the iView Arts channel in addition to our TV programming, which we're very proud of. But let me first just give you an overview of what's happening this month. It's been a huge month for arts programming on the ABC. Earlier this month, we launched the Artsville documentary strand, which runs on the main channel, ABC One, every Tuesday night at 9:30. Now, this is a really important initiative. This is one-hour documentaries, new Australian documentaries, a series of six in the first iteration, which will be ongoing. We had documentary by Sally Aitken about Frank Gehry. Next week, the week after, we had a film called Stranded about the rise of punk in Brisbane. And tonight we've got an incredible documentary called Cambodia Space Project, which is a gorgeous story about an Australian musician who heads to Cambodia and immerses himself in the tradition of 60s and 70s rock that exists in Cambodia. I mean, these are fabulous documentaries, and I think they prove a point that ABC TV is certainly not shying away from programming on its main channel.
Okay, now the book show continues, does it?
Oh, absolutely. Every first Sunday of every month. That's certainly
okay,
not
that's
changing. Jen Byrne is an incredibly important part of the arts programming team.
Now, let's talk about the way you view iView? Because my understanding is that ABC management is starting to think of iView sort of as another station rather than just as a way of catching up with what you might have missed on the telly.
Yeah, so part of the initiative that we've just launched with the iView Arts channel, it's seen as a pilot channel where iView is increasingly reaching out into a streaming space beyond the catch-up that it's relatively known for. And in doing this, we are responding to audiences' demands. We know that there is a huge desire for digital-first streaming content. There have been, you know, players come into the Australian market, Stan, Presto, Netflix. Everyone sort of knows the story on that front. And these digital-first commissions and curated collections and acquired content that now exists solely in iView is to respond to that audience need. So what we are basically servicing is a desire from niche audiences, like an arts audience, to watch content anytime on any device, and we think it's a really exciting step.
You know, I hate the word content.
Sorry, Michael.
I'm fed up with hearing about content. I mean, they're programs, aren't they? They're documentaries. Content's such a sort of jargony word.
Well, no,
I'm sick of being a content supplier. There, I've said it out loud.
No, let me counter you on that. We absolutely show films, documentaries, programs, but part of the collection that we're presenting in the iView channel are short clips from the archive. So we're building up a mosaic, for example, of Australian musical history. And these are short clips. They're only 3 minutes.
So how will I
find
it?
We may get caught up on semantics here, but I do think, you know, we need to be clear that there is a broad range of content offerings that will be available to audiences via the iView channel. And it means you can watch a short arts series by, for example, Brendan Hutchins, who produced a beautiful series called On Assignment, which is about photography. Each episode is about 8 minutes long. So you can have your cup of coffee in the morning and watch a gorgeous piece of arts content.
Have as much content as you desire. Now, we've got to be quick here, Nicola, because time's going to beat us. But when I go to iView, there'll be some kind of tab or something there, will there, that says this is the arts bit?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going out quite loud. So if you follow the navigation and you look for the yellow button next to all of the main channels that you know so well, so the ABC 1, ABC 2, 3, Kids, and right next to that is an arts channel logo. Click on that. Takes you into a full suite of offering, over 70 titles this month alone, building every month going forward. There's a lot of really beautiful programming there, and we're excited about it.
Meanwhile, the ABC Arts Portal online is closing. Why are we losing that?
I suppose it's just a symptom of the times, really. Technology dates quite quickly, as we all know. And when the Arts Portal launched in 2009 with a great amount of enthusiasm, it responded to, I suppose, the technology of the time. And what we're seeing now is that we have these amazing platforms at our disposal in iView and News Online, and our audiences are telling us, because of the numbers attached to both those platforms, that is the primary place that they are going to engage with arts news or arts documentaries or feature films or whatever they want to watch.
Or other forms of content, Nicola.
Or other forms of content, exactly. So it's just understanding that in this current day and age, the niche websites don't service the needs of our audience as well as they should.
We get it. Nicola, thank you so much for filling us in and bringing us up to date.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Nicola Harvey is the supervising producer and editor of ABC Arts Online, including iView. And I'd love to know what you make of all this. You must have strong views on the way in which you engage with the arts here on the ABC, the way we broadcast arts, or the way in which we have arts available to you online. Do let us know. Maybe you've got some good ideas about how we could make things even better. And that concludes proceedings for this evening. Don't forget Clive James coming up on our next show. Fiona Gruber hosting that one. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. A very good night to you.